On a Wednesday, this is Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
Hello, I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Coming up today, we've got All Things Considered host Ari Shapiro talking about his new memoir, his approach to journalism, and yes, his singing career.
Looking forward to that. And a little later, we sit down with a MacArthur genius. Yuval Sharon is changing the world of opera, one groundbreaking performance at a time. His latest show tells a classic story in reverse and is coming to Philadelphia this weekend.
All right.
But first, you know, we got to jump into the news.
Let's round up some news, Cherry.
All right. Safe injection sites are in the news again. Pennsylvania lawmakers, they've taken the first step to get the sites banned statewide in the Commonwealth. This is a big deal, Avi, because the sites, which would allow individuals to use illicit drugs under the supervision of medical staff, has been a very contentious issue. But now the Senate Judiciary Committee, they've cleared a bill that would criminalize the operation of such a site. Let me tell you about this. It would impose a sentence for people who operate the site of up to 20 years behind bars. The individuals could get fined up to $500,000, and the organizations that operate them could be fined up to $2 million. And this measure passed out of that committee 11-3.
And that margin tells you that there are Democrats.
A lot of Democrats agree
with this proposed ban. And that's one of the things that makes this issue interesting, is that there's a split within the Democratic Party on the issue of supervised safe injection sites. Of course, we have to mention that harm reduction advocates believe these sites, and they point to research, are life savers for people who might otherwise overdose on illicit drugs.
And that's absolutely true. And New York has two sites, New York City. Providence, Rhode Island recently opened one. And they've been operating in Canada, Australia, and in Europe for more than a decade. Yeah. But, you know, as you mentioned, I mean, we have split. I mean, state senators in Pennsylvania who are Democrats who say their constituencies do not want these sites in their neighborhoods. Also, our governor, Josh Shapiro, has said that he believes that these sites are illegal. And all of this comes as, you know, Safe House, a nonprofit that wanted to open one in Philadelphia, is still working things out with the DOJ.
And for a long time, we thought Philadelphia would be the first place in this country to have one of these supervised injection sites. And now, of course, you mentioned New York City and Providence already have them up and running. And it does not look like there's a lot of momentum right now here in Pennsylvania to get this done. We'll keep our eye on it. Wanted to talk a little bit about food today, Cherry. There was an item that caught our eye in the Inquirer from Alfred Lubrano talking about a new study by this group out of Chicago that looks at basically what types of food people prefer in different generations. And for years and decades, it's always been Italian food. People say Italian food is their favorite of all the different types of cuisine.
But now?
Not so much anymore. Gen Z and millennials are leaning toward Mexican and Chinese over Italian. So there's this shift happening in the types of food that people prefer. So Italian was the king for a long, long time, but the throne now seems to be at least contested.
And I will say Taco Tuesday is like my favorite day of the week. So I wonder wonder if there's like PR, you know, involved in that. Also, I know, you know, a lot of folks grow up eating all sorts of food. I know my niece loves sushi. She grew up eating a lot of sushi and different types of food. So I wonder if that's part of it, too. A lot more eating out instead of eating at home. And so you're exposed more. Immigration, probably big part of that as well.
I think it's a beautiful thing. And I love all these cuisines, Italian, Mexican, Chinese. We could go on and on. I'll eat them all. But, you know, I do a lot of archival research for my weekly history threads that I do. And one thing that I stumbled upon, this always stuck out to me. In 1960, the Philadelphia Inquirer ran a column explaining to people what marinara sauce is.
Oh.
Like literally just explaining to them what this is, what marinara sauce is. It's this red sauce, it goes on pasta. 1960. And so this is what happens, right? In these waves, you have one generation learns about a new type of cuisine brought by an immigrant group to this country. They come to adopt it. It becomes part of the American palate. And then the next cuisine and the next wave comes along, and it all creates this beautiful melting pot. I mean, it almost does make sense to call it a melting pot. And I think it's one of the most underappreciated things about this country. There is such a variety of food you can experience in a city like Philadelphia. And when you travel around the world, you realize that you take that for granted when you grow up.
We really do. And we cannot hashtag food porn. You go on any, you know,
website.
Yes, you go on any like social media and tons of pictures of food, you know, tons of cuisine. So there you go. Avi, do you know? I mean, there's a new quiz, Billy Penn. Okay. I know you have a very good relationship with Billy Penn with quizzes
Billy
and
Penn,
stuff.
Yeah.
They have introduced a quiz to match you with your mayoral candidate.
I took this quiz this morning.
Yes.
Yeah, it's cool. Basically, you answer a bunch of questions and they tell you which, you know, mayoral candidate in Philadelphia you
line
up with.
It's a lot of questions, too.
It's 42 questions, I think.
Yeah.
And it's really, I think it's an interesting way. People might think, oh, you do a quiz, that's a little frivolous. I actually think it's an interesting way to sort of work through all of the issues. And there are many, many issues floating around in this campaign and just sort of figure out who you align with. I would encourage people to check it out, BillyPenn.com.
I definitely think it's cool. And we've been interviewing the different mayoral candidates. Mm-hmm. Tomorrow we have Amon Brown. So, you know, see if what you pick, whether or not, you know, you line up with the person that you think you're leaning towards.
I don't think there's any right or wrong way to figure out how to vote. I think a quiz is a perfectly legitimate way to figure out, like, just like sort of who's in your ideological backyard, you know?
Exactly. And since we're talking about, you know, the big job of mayor, there's another big job announcement that came today from Fresh Air. They announced that after years-long search, they have a new co-host. The one and only award-winning public media journalist, Tanya Mosley.
Congratulations, Tanya Mosley. Congratulations to Fresh Air with Terry Gross. The reason why this is big news is because of what those folks, and I'm pointing right behind us here, because that's where their cubicles are, because of what those folks have built over generations. And it's just super exciting to kind of be able to map out the future of Fresh Air, which is something we've all wondered about for a long time.
And you probably remember Tanya from Here and Now, and she's been guest hosting for a while. So now
a great
official
interviewer.
Official.
Absolutely a worthy person to take the baton. So we're going to do our newsmaker interview now. Speaking of news and interviews, we're going to do one of our own. And this is a serious topic. Classes for most students in the school district of Philadelphia will end in mid-June. But in the past few months, many students have been forced to switch to remote learning, not because of COVID, but because of asbestos, a once common building material that is okay if it's intact, but is a big toxic problem when damaged.
So far, five buildings in the district have been closed after asbestos was discovered, and these are not small schools. We're talking about Frankfort High, for example. More than 900 students will not be returning to their classrooms. And so here to tell us more about what's going on is Kristen Graham, who's been following this story very closely as an education reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Kristen, thank you so much for joining us on Studio 2.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
So we want to lay a foundation here. If you can give us an explainer on asbestos, it's okay if it's intact, but when it's damaged, there's an issue. Could you talk about that as well as how the existence of asbestos and the danger of it has been misidentified in these schools?
Sure. So the thing to know about the Philadelphia School District is that it's got a bunch of really old buildings, right? Average age of a Philadelphia School District building is about 73 years old. And we know that asbestos was used in building construction before, I think, about 1978. That's when, you know, kind of revelations that it was toxic and shouldn't be used. And as you said, like, if it's, you know, if it's there and it's undamaged, it's totally fine. But it really does need to be monitored closely in case it becomes damaged. And so what happens is basically there's this federal law that governs, you know, asbestos, and every school needs to be inspected every 3 years. And, you know, damage needs to be noted. And then if there is damage to asbestos, you know, depending on how serious it is in the district's capacity, it's either, you know, removed or encapsulated or whatever, or they just say, we're going to keep an eye on it. And they check the damage every 6 months. And so what happened is this is a year when the school district is conducting its, you know, 3 year inspections. And, you know, the first school that we noted went out was Building 21, which is a high school in West Oak Lane, a district high school in West Oak Lane. And that was on March 1st. The school closed initially. It was going to be for a few days, and then, you know, it got longer. And now the repairs have been completed. Some air testing is happening, and the kids at Building 21 could be going back on May 1st.
So, Kristen, my understanding is that the root of many of these most recent closures is mislabeling. It almost sounds like a clerical issue. Can you explain to us what got mislabeled and how?
Right. So what happened is, you know, initially the Building 21 asbestos was supposedly new damage. And then as they go back and they're, you know, looking throughout the building, you know, the district comes out and says, actually, there is asbestos that had been, you know, misidentified for years, that it was supposed to be safe. And actually, it's labeled non-asbestos containing material. And it turns out that this plaster that was, you know, pretty significant parts in the building was actually asbestos containing. And so then, you know, that everything gets thrown into question. The district has to follow up. So now we know that sometime in the 1990s, there was, you know, for whether it was a clerical error or whether it was deliberate, you know, we don't know. We'll probably never know. But, you know, that's something that the district basically now has to go back and recheck a bunch of buildings and do new sampling. Does this plaster actually contain asbestos?
Yeah. And you wrote this morning, I mean, because there's proposals for solutions. For example, Councilmember Isaiah Thomas said yesterday that an independent body should oversee these building repairs and new construction. Talk more about this. Has this type of thing been done before?
So there have been other, you know, governmental agencies that do it. New Jersey has a school building construction authority that handles this kind of thing for not every district, but for some districts. And that's certainly something that Councilmember Thomas thinks would be a good idea. You know, it could be a freestanding authority like the Philadelphia Energy Authority or PIDC, or it could be that one of these existing authorities takes on responsibility. Now, definitely not a done deal. You know, the council member has said he's had conversations with the school district, but it's not like the school district is just going to say, yeah, we're going to do this. Mm-hmm. So lots to be determined. And the district has sued the city over changes to a city law that passed last year that basically the city ultimate authority.
And you are breaking up there, Kristen. Is Kristen still online? Can you hear us, Kristen?
I can hear you.
Oh, great. There you are. So I wanted to, we've talked a lot about adults bickering. What's the impact here on the kids? We have a lot of kids now who are going to school online. Are they going to school online? Is learning still happening? What's the prognosis for the students affected?
Yeah, so it's really mixed bag. It depends on the school.
Oh, Kristen, unfortunately, we're not able to pick you up right now. So I think we are coming toward the end of this segment anyway, so I think we will have to say goodbye to Kristen Graham, who is education reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Every so often the technology betrays us, Cherry, but there's so much more to say on this topic, and I do want to emphasize school infrastructure is a topic we want to revisit in a longer segment, in a longer interview. We'd love to have Kristen back on in one of those future segments, because this goes beyond asbestos, mold, dust, heat, cooling. There are so many issues with old buildings in the School District of Philadelphia that have not been properly maintained.
And we're at a tipping point. I think everybody's attention is on the school. And the silver lining here is that because of this asbestos, hopefully these kids will get better facilities and all of the adults are paying attention.
And when I covered this issue as an education reporter, and Kristen and I, we were colleagues for a long time, it is one of the first things you notice when you walk into these buildings.
Absolutely.
They are simply not properly maintained for all sorts of structural reasons. And we'll get into it another time. Coming up on Studio 2, we have NPR All Things Considered host Ari Shapiro talking about his memoir, The Best Strangers in the World, Stories from a Life Spent Listening. You don't want to miss it. Stick with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
And you are listening to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg.
All right, Ari Shapiro. You know the name Cherry.
Of course.
Of course. We spend a lot of our afternoons talking after he finishes talking because Ari is one of the hosts of All Things Considered from NPR.
Yeah, I really love him. He's also a professional singer, right?
Mm-hmm.
And now an author.
He is all of those things. He just wrote a memoir called The Best Strangers in the World, Stories from a Life Spent Listening. I got to speak with Ari recently about the book and also the forces that shape his view of journalism. I found that very fascinating. Ari was born in North Dakota, grew up in Portland, Oregon, went to Yale, but he got his start at NPR as an intern for the famous legal correspondent Nina Totenberg. And our conversation actually starts right after Ari's internship with Nina Totenberg ended. One of my favorite stories in the book is about how she tries to help you get a job as the internship is winding down. Can you tell that story?
She's so amazing. I mean, I think it says so much about her that as I was looking for a job, didn't know what I was going to do, didn't have any promising leads. She knew that I loved to cook. I'd been living in this shared studio apartment with somebody who I found on Craigslist. And so she said, why don't I hire you to come to my house, cook dinner for a bunch of people who I'll invite who could all give you jobs? And so she invited the former deputy attorney general and a member of Congress and like very high-level Washington VIPs.
Yeah.
I spent all day cooking in her kitchen and then sat down to dinner with all of these amazing people. And she sort of made the pitch saying like, this is my intern Ari. He's very good. He's very smart. He's very motivated. He needs a job. I didn't get a job out of that evening, but remembering what she did for me and the risk she took kind of sticking her neck out and inviting people who she respected and admired and wouldn't have wanted to embarrass herself in front of and trusting me to cook for them, like, that was an amazing gesture.
It's an insanely generous thing to do.
Totally.
For a boss to an intern.
Completely. Absolutely.
You worn a lot of hats at NPR, and eventually one of those hats was White House correspondent mm-hmm. during the Obama years. For a lot of people, this is the apex, major national news organization, White House correspondent. Seemed like you took the job kicking and screaming.
Yeah, I mean, that's not totally wrong. I turned down the job the first time I was asked to do it. I thought, you know, yeah, this is a prestigious job, but frankly, it feels a little like it might be unfulfilling because the negative stereotype of covering the White House is that you're just a stenographer to power. Like every day you're reporting, today the president said, today the president did, and you're in a place that is full of dozens of other reporters covering the exact same thing. It's really hard to get any new story that other people aren't telling. And I was just afraid that I was going to be unable to do work that would have any impact or be memorable. But what I didn't realize was that, first of all, it's an incredible learning opportunity. In the years that I was on the White House beat, every day I had to digest something complicated and new in a way that has prepared me so much for hosting All Things Considered. Because when you're covering the White House, like, you wake up one day and the story is nuclear policy, and you wake up the next day and the story is the debt ceiling, and the day after that, it is the coronavirus pandemic, and suddenly you have to know about epidemiology and economics and nuclear policy. And so being on the White House beat, even though it was beat reporting, forced me to learn how to really, really quickly get up to speed on a whole lot of different things.
It's an omnivorous type of beat.
Totally.
In a lot of ways. But
Because I was not a political junkie, I think I didn't filter every story through the lens of, and here's what it means for the Republicans versus the Democrats. And so I think I was able to tell more human and hopefully more interesting stories that weren't just kind of like horse race, who's up, who's down, which is a trap that I think a lot of political journalists sometimes fall into.
I actually want to stay on that topic a little bit because you then became NPR's London correspondent. And in that chapter, you mention a story you did that I still remember.
Wow, which one was it?
About distillery cats.
Oh my God, yes.
Who rid the distilleries of pests.
Oh,
and
has
in
such
Scotland.
A sad ending, though. But yeah,
don't spoil
on.
It. Don't
okay,
spoil it.
I won't.
In Scotland, you met a kitten named mm-hmm. Pete who was about to become the new head mouser at this very old distillery in Scotland. And I want to play the end of the piece.
Hi, Pete. Oh my God, you're so tiny.
Back at Glenturret Distillery in Scotland, Pete is just 6 months old, a little puffball the color of smoke. We approach with our big, fluffy microphone, hoping to pick up a teeny meow.
He has grabbed the microphone. I think he's got the instincts.
Pete clearly has the killer reflexes of a champion mouser, not to mention the looks. Ari Shapiro, NPR, Muse.
Puffball of Smoke is a great line, by the way.
Well, his name is spelled P-E-A-T.
P-E-A-T.
Yeah. I forgot that I signed off on that story, NPR. I think my producer, Rich Preston, dared me to do it. And I was like, all right, I'll do it.
That might be why I remember the story, though. But here's my question off of that. There are a lot of capital S stories, big J journalism stories you can talk about in a book like this. And you get to a lot of them. Why is that story in there?
Because I loved it. Because it was so funny. Because there is, when you're ready to share it, a postscript punchline that I had to include. But also, like, I have always felt like some people think of the news as darkness and misery, and sure, there is an aspect of what we cover that is, like, talking to people on the worst day of their lives. But life is more than that, and what we should portray in our news coverage is, like, the wonderful variety that makes up the texture of a life and a life in journalism. It's not just... And then here's this other person I met who was really in a bad way. Like, being a journalist allows me to go in and not just, you know, talk to somebody in rural India whose home is being swallowed by rising seas, but also meet Pete the distillery cat during his very brief life.
Yeah, so the punchline, right, is...
Well, that story sat on a shelf for a while before it finally aired. And when it did air, Rich, my producer, got an email. He kind of blanched. And then he told me he just heard from the distillery that the previous day, that little kitten Pete had been hit by a car and died. And they wanted to give the staff 24 hours to absorb the news before they announced it publicly. And in those 24 hours, our story aired. And so the next day, NPR's Robert Siegel, host of All Things Considered, aired an obituary for Pete the Cat. And it mentioned that people online were already suggesting names for his replacement. And one of the most popular ones was, Avi, you want to give the punchline?
Repeat. R.I.P. Pete, by the way.
R.I.P.
But I think there is something really important in that. I don't bring it up just because it's a good story. And that
I'm
happened.
So glad that you remember it, though.
It's because I remember it. That, to me, is so meaningful because I hear a lot of stories every day. And frankly... It's like swimming in a river of stories.
Oh, totally. Yes, absolutely.
And only a few stand out. And they are often stories like that.
Yeah. One analogy that I have used as I think about sort of why I wanted to write this book is that covering the news every day feels like standing on the bank of a swollen river, and like branches and leaves go by and that you just they float on downstream and you never see them again. And there's something nice about that, that, like, you know, it's constantly changing. But what I realize is that, like, some have snagged as they've gone by, and they've changed me and shaped the person I am. And so what I wanted to explore in this book was both how the stories I've told have shaped the person I've become, and also how my identity and history and the person I am shapes the stories that I tell. So it's kind of two sides of the coin.
Let me reintroduce you. You know the voice, of course. We're talking with Ari Shapiro. His memoir just came out. It's called The Best Strangers in the World, Stories from a Life Spent Listening. It is a memoir, but I think as we're talking about here, I think that's also a thesis statement about journalism and what you want journalism to be. I'm going to read a quote here. I'm happy to interview a senator or a cabinet secretary about the political controversy du jour, but I think news organizations often make a mistake by valorizing those bone-dry interviews over flesh and blood stories of culture, emotion, and personal experience. And I feel that as someone who listens to All Things Considered every day as part of my job. Is there some way you would reorder All Things Considered so it more matches that vision?
I actually think, thanks to everybody, not just me, we are moving in that direction. Hmm. And when we talk about how we are going to cover a major story in the news, way more than when I started in journalism, even way more than when I started hosting All Things Considered, people want to talk to folks who are affected by policy. People want to discuss pop culture and the way that it shapes our lives. People want to discuss the thing that everyone is talking about in a smart, thoughtful, informative way. This isn't TMZ, nor should it be, But if there is something that is the topic of conversation that everybody is mulling over, I think there's more enthusiasm now for us to find a way that we, as All Things Considered, can do our smart treatment of it rather than say, well, let's, you know, leave that to the people who cover pop culture, which is not us.
I think a lot of people probably pull this out from the book because it is seems kind of stunning, I suppose, to us even just 20 years later. 2004.
Yeah.
you wanted to get married.
Yeah.
To your longtime partner, and you asked your bosses for permission.
Yeah, he was my college boyfriend, and we'd been together for years by that point. And I did ask my bosses, who to their credit were like, yes, of course, go get married.
Right, but of course it's the asking, right, that we find interesting, I think, looking back 19 yeah. years later.
Well, at the time, gay marriage was not legal in right. the vast majority of the country, in almost the entire country. And Gavin Newsom was at the time the mayor of San Francisco, and he just decided he was going to start doing same-sex marriage. And so in a way, getting married in that context could have been seen as an act of protest or an act of civil disobedience. To me, it was an act of love, an act of commitment. It was just getting married. It's funny to think about now because the needle has moved so much that it seems absurd. And yet at the time, it was a huge controversy. And I had friends who were queer, who had been with their partners much longer than I'd been with Mike, who would later go on to get married, but wanted to wait until the issue was resolved because they, as journalists, didn't want to be seen as stepping into a battle in the culture wars.
So I am wondering, it's hard to square that Ari Shapiro with the person talking so openly about his life in this book. And I'm wondering if you feel that what's changed in those 19 years is simply our societal attitudes toward the institution of gay marriage, or if in addition to that, your opinion about big O objectivity in journalism has changed.
Oh, both are completely true. I mean, just factually speaking, gay marriage is no longer a controversy as it was 20 years ago. And also, I, at this point in my career, as somebody who's been hosting All Things Considered for 7 years, who is in his mid-40s, who has a strong sense of self, am not going to apologize for the fact that I got married or even, like, let's go beyond marriage, which is a very, very, like, you know, institutional, small-c conservative right. structure. You know, I write in the book about partying with the radical fairies and, like, going to an underwear party with Alan Cumming. And, like, there are other things that 20 years ago I would have been like, oh, my God, is my career going to end? Like, can I actually do this? And part of what I want to do in the book is tie together all of these different threads and say that, like, you can be many things at once. And objectivity is a worthwhile goal. And that doesn't mean you don't carry your identity and history and personality and thoughts with you.
You would want a young journalist today to have the confidence that I suppose, or the sense of self that you have now, and not feel that a young journalist would have to kind of, I don't know, obscure who they are.
Yeah, and, you know, part of what I see as I look back on my 20-year career is that when I initially felt like journalism might not be a place for a person like me, some of that might have been just feeling like a fish out of water or imposter syndrome or call it whatever you want. And some of it might have been true that, like, journalism actually was not a welcoming place for people like me. But I sort of decided, well, I'm just going to sort of set up camp here and maybe at some point it will become more welcoming. And I also realized that I was far from the first person who had done that. In fact, NPR was founded by a bunch of incredible women who could not find a place in hard news journalism elsewhere. All Things Considered was the first nationally broadcast news program to be anchored by a woman, Susan Stamberg. And so, like, I was inheriting this long tradition of people saying, I'm going to help journalism evolve. And there are people younger than me working on All Things Considered now, helping journalism evolve in ways that I might not have been aware of.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, we're talking with Ari Shapiro, author of the new memoir, The Best Strangers in the World, Stories from a Life Spent Listening. Host of All Things Considered, which you hear all the time here on WHYY, and a Renaissance man, which I got to get to. Okay, when I read the book, it was almost like you have a Forrest Gumpian way of just sort of floating
Forrest
through the
world. Forrest Gumpian way, I love that. That is so good.
Floating through the world and just getting sucked into the orbit of these famous, talented people. I believe it's because you have talent, but the way it's written in the book is almost like you're just being sort of randomly, magnetically pulled into their world.
I do feel that way sometimes.
Well, I felt that when you were writing it. So I want you to tell folks about the band / orchestra, Pink Martini, and how you ended up touring with them.
So they're from Portland, Oregon, where I grew up, and I have been a fan of theirs since I was in high school, and they've been around for almost 30 years. And I became friends with them over the years. Whenever they would come to Washington, D.C., I would throw a party for them. And one of those evolved into a kind of late-night sing-along around the piano upstairs at my house. And Pink Martini's band leader is the pianist, Thomas Lauderdale. And the next morning, he called me and he said, "Hey, Ari, I forgot you can really sing. And we're writing this song for the next album that we want a man to sing." And actually, that night, the band was performing at a venue just outside D.C. called Wolf Trap, which is sort of this beautiful outdoor summer destination. So I remember being backstage at Wolf Trap with Thomas, and he was on this rickety old out-of-tune upright piano, and he started playing. They had taken this Schubert melody and put a big band swing beat to it, and they were in the process of writing lyrics to this song called But Now I'm Back. A few months later, the song was written, and I recorded it in Portland with the band. And then Thomas said, "Well, now we need to find a time for you to perform live with us. So why don't you come to the Hollywood Bowl?" Which, as you may be aware, seats 18,000 people. And so that was the first place I ever sang with any band anywhere in front of a live audience, was at the Hollywood Bowl, this legendary venue that I'm happy to say I've been back to many times since and now really enjoy performing at. Although it was terrifying that first time.
This clip actually might be from Wolf Trap. It's a duet with you and Pink Martini lead singer China Forbes, and you're singing Get Happy, Happy Days, the duet. Let's give it a whirl.
Forget your troubles.
Happy days.
Come on, get happy.
Are here
you
again.
Change.
The skies
all your cares
above
away.
Are clear.
Shout hallelujah.
So let's sing
and
a
just
song
get happy.
Of cheer again.
Get ready.
Happy days
for
are
the judgment
here
day.
That is Ari Shapiro, our guest.
Playing the role of Judy Garland or Barbara Streisand? Well, the two of us. One of the two. Actually, Alan Cumming and I do the same duet and we switch parts. We do the opposite. So I always forget, like, wait, am I Barbara now or am I Judy?
And that's a totally different headspace. Are you Judy or are you Barbara?
I know. Very different.
I just want to thank you for taking the time to come in and speak with us on Studio 2. I have one more question.
Hit it.
That's a serious question.
Okay.
People call me Ari.
Yeah.
All the time.
Well, they call me Ari, so what are you going to do?
But I'm pretty sure they call me Ari because they know you and they know your voice. And they just map your name onto mine.
Hmm.
So could you lean into the microphone there and just say, my name is Ari and his name is Avi?
My name is Ari and his name is Avi.
Thank
Got
God.
It? Got it?
Got it, folks.
Is that clear?
Got it. Got it. Got it. That was a great conversation.
It
and there's
was.
So much more in the book. And we get into all, there's many more serious stories that he's done over the years and hard-hitting stuff. And we did talk about that, didn't make the interview, but I do think you should check it out in the book.
Yeah, Avi Ari. Avi Ari. Love it.
You got it.
Coming up, we are talking to the acclaimed director Yuval Sharon about his newest production at Opera Philadelphia. Get your opera glasses out for Puccini's La Boheme in reverse.
It's coming up on Studio 2.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
A triumphant welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Opera Philadelphia is ending its season with Puccini's La Bohème, one of the most performed operas in the world. The musical Rent was based on this story. But this production, though, has a twist. It is told in reverse, starting at Act 4 and ending with Act 1. Of course, it's still the story of the Bohemian artists living in Paris in the 1830s and the love story between the poor seamstress Mimi and Rodolfo. But Opera Philadelphia's production begins with Mimi's tragic death.
And this production has received rave reviews and performances all over the country. It is the work of director and MacArthur genius. That's not me saying that. That's MacArthur. Yuval Sharon, who is making his Opera Philadelphia debut. Yuval is the artistic director of Detroit Opera, but he is joining us here in Studio 2 here in Philadelphia to talk about this production, the inspiration for performing this beloved opera in reverse, and how he is redefining opera for new audiences. Welcome, Yuval.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be here.
So we did a little synopsis there, but a lot of folks might not know La Bohème, so just give us the quick rundown of what the show is about, the traditional version.
Sure. Well, you know, what's so wonderful about La Bohème and why it's been performed so often is because it's almost less about the story and more about the atmosphere and the energy of what it means to be really young, full of energy, full of life, maybe a bit naive as to what life is about, but you think you know everything, you know? You know, you understand how everything's supposed to work, and you might not have any money, you might not have a job, but you're still loving life, you know? And you're drunk, and drunk on life, and drunk on your friendships, and drunken love, you know, all of that stuff is just part of what it means to be alive. And it's before you think about death, and it's before you think about sickness, it's before you think about mortgages and children and all of that kind of stuff, you know. It's like before that moment happens, there is a magic. And Puccini absolutely captures that in a way that's actually not even very linear. He called this opera an opera in four pictures, and it's based on a story that is, the original novel was called Scenes Out of the Life of Bohemians.
Yeah.
So because of that episodic quality, it started to make me think maybe we can get away from this kind of tyranny of chronologic thinking and maybe go more into really capturing that spirit of youthfulness and energy.
So we want to trigger people's memory with some music here. So this is the emerging artist Kara Goodrich, who is in the upcoming show, performing Mimi's aria at an Opera Philadelphia event in 2022. Let's play the clip.
Absolutely beautiful and so invigorating. Right. And it sort of comes to mind, what is old is new again. Mm-hmm. And you took a production from 1896 and made it very new millennium. So I want you to talk about your process for sort of reimagining this classic, because you made some major changes and also some more subtler ones. And you balance the familiar with the innovative. How did you find this perfect combination?
Yeah, thanks. I mean, I guess a lot of trial and error. You know, by the time it's performing here, we've done it in three other locations. So I think the first time we did it was in Detroit, where I'm artistic director. And this production actually reopened our theater after 2 years of being closed from COVID. And that, I think, was a catalyst for me to really think about what opera, first of all, why should we go back to the opera? You know, we've been closed for 2 years. Why should, you know, maybe that's the sign we need to say that's enough, you know?
Yeah.
So if people are coming back, and in many ways, if people are going to risk their lives to come back to be in a shared space with each other and all sharing the same oxygen, why? You know, and why can what can we provide that's going to be different from what you can find on YouTube or what you can see in, you know, the HD broadcasts of other operas? Going to a performance should feel special and should feel like you have to be there. You actually have to physically be there to share the same vibrations as everybody. And so I think the only for me, the only way to do it, it doesn't. I love new opera, and a big part of my own belief is in pushing new opera forward. But I do think the classic operas still have so much to say to us, but we just need to treat them like new pieces, I think, you know? And part of that means maybe taking off the kid gloves a little bit with these works and not think that just because it was always done this way, we're going to keep perpetuating the same modes of thinking. Actually, maybe we need to, maybe because it's so classic, we might be able to, you know, play around even more. You know, maybe we can be bolder because we already know it works in the conventional way.
Right.
So because of that, let's push it and let's see what this piece might still be able to tell us if we're bold enough to really treat it like a contemporary of ours as opposed to some old museum piece, you know.
How do you, though, delineate between messing around with something in a way that's sort of just gimmicky versus messing around in providing artistic value, because that is such a fine line.
Like, so
how
true.
Do you approach that?
Yeah, no, it's so true. And, you know, I think I don't blame anyone if they hear this and they're like, what a gimmick. You know, like, who cares? You know?
The reviewers have not said that. And we should be clear that they see something in this piece that really has true artistic value. And I don't know how you pulled that off.
I think it's because I didn't ever want to do it as a shock tactic, and I never wanted to do it just to point attention at myself. I'm not trying to draw my attention to me at all. I'm trying to draw the audience into the work and into the space of what the work is about. I think more importantly, I'm doing it out of love. I actually love this piece. I think it's so beautiful. But I also think because it's so beautiful, and because it's so great, let's see what else we can do with it. And let's also remind everyone that just because it was written 100 years ago, actually in the span of time, that's not that long ago, but still, it's been performed so often that the living interpreters of this work, they're shaping the experience. And I think that that's something I'd love all opera audiences to really be aware of, that you're not just watching a kind of rote repetition of something that's already happened a million times. Each and every performer, Kara, that you just heard singing, she brings herself, she brings her whole heart and her whole soul to her performance of Mimi. And that's so different from absolutely everybody else that's ever done it. And I want people to realize that and emphasize that and celebrate that. Not, she does it just as well as everybody else. You know what I mean? I think there's a camp of opera lovers that kind of thinks that way, that there's a benchmark and we're always just trying to hit some old benchmark. But I think instead we should always be trying to set new benchmarks and reassessing the benchmarks. Like, those are benchmarks that were made from a long time ago, and the world has changed. And because of that, I do think opera actually can change with the world in any way. Many ways it could lead our way of thinking about the world.
And I got to ask you about Opera Philadelphia. I love Opera Philadelphia.
Yeah,
very unique. They try to make opera more accessible and inclusive.
Yeah.
Why was this the perfect space for this production?
Yeah.
And what do you think needs to happen to make opera more accessible and inclusive?
Yeah. Well, I personally think that experiments like this that are done with love but are not afraid to really try and push into new territory, I think that's a way to make opera feel fresh, you know, for audience members. And my experience so far with this production, again, this is the fourth time that this production's happened. But the first three times, it was fascinating to see that people that knew nothing about opera, that were trying opera for the first time, in Detroit, actually, half of the audience had never been to the opera before. And that's a big number when you think about that.
Yeah.
And I think when we asked them why they came, it was a combination that they said, well, we want to see a classic opera, but we also want to see something different, which sounds contradictory, but it doesn't have to be. You can actually have it all. You know, you can have it both
ways.
You can
have it all.
You can. Well, you can, you know, because the only point in doing an older work is if you think it has something to say to us right now.
Absolutely.
And I think that people picked up on that. And people that were brand new to opera, you know, they didn't feel like they needed to have a music degree to understand it. You know, they didn't need it. They didn't need to know Italian because, you know, the translations are happening simultaneously. And they just could tell that we were treating it like real theater and real, like something that really has something exciting to say. Well, so it just spoke.
Absolutely. Know? Well, I have a list of questions I didn't get to ask you, but we have to cut it off there. Yuval Sharon, thank you so much for joining us here on Studio 2.
Thank you so much. Great to talk to
Yuval. Yuval Sharon is making his opera Philadelphia debut, directing his new production of Puccini's La Bohème, presented in reverse order. It's running the 28th, 30th, 5th, and 7th here in Philadelphia.
Wow, that was a 2019 Opera Philadelphia recording with soprano Ashley Marie Roblard singing Musetta's Waltz. I want to see that show. Can't wait. And that's it.
For our show, Studio
2. Studio 2. Our producers are Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Our engineer is Diana Martinez.
For more of our show, head to whyy.org/studio2. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Thank you so much for joining us.